This is a Crowd podcast.
Hi, we're Football Book Club podcast, and we need your support. Now, let's drop the appeal music. Hi, everyone. James here, and I just want to tell you about the brand new Football Book Club Club, which you can join to receive bonus weekly episodes, access to exclusive member events, and your very own Football Book Club bookmark, all for the same price as a used copy of Darren Huckabee's 2007 book, Hux. So if you enjoy the podcast and need to hear more afterwards, head to patreon.com/footballbookclub. Enjoy the episode. Michael Owen, Liverpool legend, England hero, film hater, once met Lara Croft, as we found out last week, plus author. But let's see what the book club thought of his 2006 book, Off the Record, as we continue the Michael Owen trilogy in this week's Football Book Club.
Yeah, get back in front of those 10-year-olds. I want to see you fight a 10-year-old.
I can imagine he's a big fan of, like, Danny Dyer's Deadliest Men.
And Phil Neville can tell the weather with his tits. Hello and welcome to Football Book Club, the only book club where, instead of literary classics, each week we read another footballer's autobiography. Less a Jerome K. Jerome, more Cameron Jerome.
Jack, I'm not sure I've heard of Jerome K. Jerome.
He wrote Three Men in a Boat.
What's that?
The Rory McGrath Show. He wrote that. Thanks. It was called Three Men in a Boat, right? Yeah. It's a classic old book. Thanks, Daxie Wilson, for that one. Actually, that's maybe a good tactic in the future. Just write authors that Jack's never heard of and he won't slag you off.
Yeah. In order to appear culture, like, yes, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, this Jane Austen sounds fantastic.
I'm James Mugg, and over the weeks we'll be reading classics such as Robbie Fowler's My Life in Football and Emil Heskey's Even Heskey Scored. Oh, God, tragic. But today we're back in with the second instalment in the Michael Owen trilogy. And joining me, as always, are Jack Bernhardt.
Hello.
James Balgin.
Hello.
And Natasha Daniels.
Hello.
Book two. Book two. You've had a week to digest it. How are you feeling after our first instalment in person?
I'm glad that we're like over the, you know, halfway mark.
Yes.
We're on the home stretch.
Well, we're not. This is the thing.
We're not. You know, I'm trying to contain the sense of rage and betrayal and anger that I feel right
wait,
now.
Wait. Betrayal by who?
You!
Why have I betrayed you?
We've never done Dougie Friedman. We've never done Clinton Morrison.
Well, there's
two reasons that
neither of them got a book. And that's actually the only reason. Neither people have got books.
There's good reasons. I am incredibly sick of reading the same stories about 2000 Liverpool to 2004 Liverpool.
Yes, that is a good point.
Also that you said, in the future, we might read some books by Robbie Fowler and Emil Heskey. More players from Liverpool, 2000 to 2004. What are you trying to do to us? If I have to hear one more time about how Gerard Houllier transformed the Liverpool dressing room, I think I'm going to scream.
It is true. I have read so many stories.
It feels like you're
Gerard
doing
Houllier.
That thing, you know, where Darren Brown like secretly trains you to do something. Like, are we all going to be dropped into some mastermind chair where we all have to answer questions about 2002 Liverpool series?
Every possibility.
So that's what that 20-foot cutout of Gary McAllister was. I keep seeing. Every time I'm out and about, I see that. Like, what is that?
Yeah, I've actually been building a shrine to Vladimir Smicer in my back garden. Yeah. I've had no idea why.
All very useful activities. Probably more useful than reading most of these books. But anyway, last week we covered young Owen, early Liverpool, you know, France 98 Owen. This week we're reading a much more book-like book. His 2006 autobiography, Off the Record, as we, you know, continue the Owen story and we meet a slightly older Michael Owen, a more mature Michael capturing the end of Liverpool, Madrid, the beginning of Newcastle, that kind of time. Are you excited to find out about this stage of Michael?
I feel like we'd already, to an extent, I feel like I knew this side of Michael, and learning a bit more about it was something I didn't need to do.
Okay.
I just didn't need it in my life.
Okay.
And yet I've done it.
And you feel better for it?
Well, I feel slightly better. I suppose I do think that Michael Owen has sort of matured a little bit, because he tells the same golf story that he told last week about how his game went rubbish when he found out that he was going to be in the England squad, he's like, oh, my game went to pot. But this time he doesn't reveal the fact that he went on to beat his dad. So he has kind of matured a bit. Like,
he feels
he's
a bit like the last book was the sort of pointillist version of his life, and this one is the more like impressionist version of the same time period.
That's a very interesting way of putting it.
Tash, it's interesting you say that. We kind of get to learn these different, you know, sides of it, these different parts of it, because the book on the back promises it's Michael Owen's full account of his life on and off the pitch, told with real edge, promising a revealing insight into the world of professional footballer and football. And just to give you a little bit of an example of that kind of edge that Michael Owen offers us in the book, I have this here. I suppose I'm quite old-fashioned when it comes to playing the game. Umbro, one of my major sponsors, are always trying to twist my arm to get more colour into the boots they make for me. And as I've grown older, I've let them inject a little more white. So that's how... that is how... That's the level of edginess we're going to be dealing with today.
Can my size be more audible? Would you like them to be more audible?
He's getting to know himself better. And let's find out even more about Michael as we read off the record. So over the show, we're going to go into more depth about the book. We have a quiz at the end, and Ken's back with his chant challenge. But first, you might hear what Amazon's saying.
Yeah.
You might hear that.
Give us a little Amazon review.
I'll give you a little Amazon review. The book has 4.3 stars out of 5 from 25 reviews.
Not bad at all. Yeah. 4.3, because it was 3.5 last week, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's jumped up.
For the Smash Hits annual.
3.5 from 3. Now it's 4.3 from 25. Including this 5-star review from Omar, who apparently is a verified Amazon reviewer, which I didn't know was a thing.
Oh.
He had a little tick next to his name. So.
Oh yeah, you got to be in the know though.
This guy's a pretty important, a pretty big deal. We should get him on the show.
Yeah,
Omar. His review is titled "Great Book," and it reads: "The book came fast in brilliant condition. Life story told by Michael Owen is amazing and interesting. His private photographs adds a lot of value to the story. Must read to any fan.
Read to any fan. Not so if." Find any fan, read it to them.
Read them straight away. Also, I'd look to see what it means to be a verified Amazon reviewer, and I looked in some of his other reviews. He left this review for toilet paper. 3 out of 5 stars. The title was called Suspicious. And the review reads, it said no bleach, and so why are they so white, and why am I getting a reaction? Something isn't right.
But he praised Michael Owen's book for coming very quickly in brilliant condition.
That's true.
And toilet paper comes in brilliant condition.
Both of them are covered in shit, but he likes one more than the other.
This is far too mean. Immediately mean. Immediately mean. Impartial. I may ask you all to remain impartial throughout the whole thing. Actually, no, I don't. That's the whole point of the podcast, to be partial.
Literally the point of the show.
So that's the all-important review from Omar himself. But what did you lesser mortals think of it? Only because he's verified. I still think you guys are amazing.
Sure, of course. Yeah.
He's important. Tash, you've already said something mean about him, so I'm going to move. Let's go, James. What did you think, James?
It was the most difficult book I've read so far out of all these
books.
Wow. It felt like I was in trying to get out of a maze for hours and kept ending up at the same point that I started. And like by the end, I was just begging for Jack Torrance to end it all with an X.
James, you're speaking my language. This is exactly
basically
right.
That's how I felt. It never ended. I was reading it for days. I was like, what? Why aren't I getting any further through this book?
And am I right in thinking you owned a copy as a child?
I did, yeah. So my version is different from you guys.
Okay.
Yeah, I must have a long time ago. But mine stops after Euro 2004. So I think that's when it was printed originally. So you guys have got another couple of years.
I'm sorry, what?
Mm.
Yours stops after Euro 2004. Ours goes on for 2 more years after that.
mine ends when Stevie G decides he's staying at Liverpool. That's when it ends.
And it still felt very long.
Oh, it was, I don't know. It was so difficult to read.
Our copy has a big thing on the back saying neatly draws a line under his Liverpool years. And I was kind of going to ask you, did it give you the closure that you wanted from the Michael Owen story? But you haven't even got that bit. So no closure for you.
It didn't.
Wow.
There's no opinion on Rafa or anything like that. It just ends when he's just about to come back after the Euros.
He's like, this seems like a natural conclusion for my life story. Rafa's it. Cool.
Also, he must have then immediately signed from Real Madrid. So he must have been like, there we go, the end of that. And then someone went, hey, do you want to go to Real Madrid? And he was like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, well, I was writing this book. I'll just sack that off and then we'll do this.
Well, I'll send it. It's fine. This bit's probably irrelevant. Moving to the biggest club in the world. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's not important. Tash, do you enjoy it?
No.
Okay.
I felt a little bit like You know the analogy of the little mice, you know, swimming in the milk and then eventually it turns to butter and they climb out, but they have to spend hours and hours. So I thought maybe there'll be a big payoff at the end where we get to crawl out of the milk churner. But no, it didn't happen. We're still swimming.
You guys are getting very imaginative with your review. You're getting very imaginative with your reviews this week.
Oh, I needed to, because I really needed to drag myself through this book with some sort of...
The pressure's building for me when it comes to me at some point. Oh, what am I going to compare it to? You know, the Sagrada Familia. Jack?
I think drowning in milk's about right.
Okay.
I really felt like to be fair, it's not entirely Michael's fault.
I honestly don't think it's his fault at all.
James, it's your fault. Okay. That's whose fault. Yeah,
I'll take that.
I just feel like it really felt like the same thing over and over and over again. And it's the disadvantage that we have also heard this story many times already.
Yes.
So I think it's a double thing of so many times in this book I've written in my notes, you've said that. You've said that. You've said that.
But is that from having read the other book? Because
It's having read this book, he repeats himself a lot.
Yeah, he does.
But we've also repeated himself in the first book as well. So you are just spending it's like being trapped in a room where someone is telling you their life story over and over again, or just telling you anecdotes over and over again. And you have to be like, no, you've told that one. Maybe it's the perfect analogy for lockdown.
It reminded me of that episode of Friday Night Dinner where they just have to keep eating rice pudding.
It was like that.
It's rice pudding, this book is.
Okay.
I quite like rice pudding. Inexplicably.
it's pretty nice. I can't eat it anymore. But in general, I liked it. I used to like it. With you saying that, I do know what all of you mean. But you touched upon something interesting when you said, I don't think it's entirely his fault. I don't think it's his fault in the slightest. I think a lot of this book is very much still they're trying to project this image of Michael Owen being cleaner than clean and, you know, whiter than Omar's toilet paper.
No bleach.
Yeah, no bleach at all. Like, really, like, no... the boy next door, the perfect image of this thing. There's no drama. It's all very inoffensive. I don't think he's had much role in this. I think it's... A tiny spoiler, I've moved ahead to the next book. I'm not going to tell you anything about it. However, having read that book a little bit, I feel like reading this book makes you feel like he's, you know, he's been like almost like held captive and made to write this. It's like propaganda. Yeah. It feels like reading propaganda, this book. It's like reading this, okay, this is what people want to see of Michael Owen in this kind of way. And I feel like it wasn't a satisfying read. I'm totally with you on that. I didn't enjoy reading it. But... I feel like there is a way out of it. And also there was one moment within this propaganda, almost like a little hidden bit that, like, beyond everything, where I actually felt I had a real breakthrough moment, which I'm going to come to later, where I really feel like I became one with Michael Owen. And I'm going to talk about that later.
We're doing sexy music.
Yeah, it was that, but in general,
isn't
you're right.
Stockholm syndrome.
I am thinking it could be that.
I kind of agree with what you're saying. I mentioned in the last episode that I feel like I've read an entire book about this man and I don't know anything about him.
Yes.
And I do kind of still feel like he's rice pudding, but at least I do know where he comes from a bit now. And, you know, he tracks his family's love of football through each generation, back to his granddad, who was a World War II sergeant, and his granny, who'd give him the 10p and the dairy milk when he score a goal.
Yes.
And that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Like, it's very wholesome. And I always thought he was really boring, obviously. But actually, I do think he's just quite sweet.
Yeah.
And he just hasn't had any, there's no grit to make a pearl. He just is an oyster, you know? There's not been any dark moments in his life. It's all very sweet and soft and gentle. So why would he be this personality-driven Zlatan type when he's just had no sort of reason to do it?
I agree. And I don't think he's in a position... He's not going to make them up, those kind of stories, is he? And he's not going to... And also, like I say, at that time, people probably did want to... Look, you know, 20-odd years later, we were reading it. 17 years later, sure, it's not the most satisfying read. But at the time... He was one of the biggest footballers in the world. And plenty of people, especially from our book, James, sorry, you haven't got this bit. He's just come back from Newcastle, made a huge homecoming from being a Galactico in Real Madrid and still was one of England's best players. This book kind of was, he probably had no choice but to have this book just appear one day. And I agree. It's a cynical cash-in, I would say. There's nothing crazy exciting in there, but I'm not holding it against Michael. I'm not holding it. If anything, I feel a bit. I agree with Tash. He comes across as a very sweet boy.
I think you people are crazy. I'm sorry.
I researched it a little bit, and when he released the third one, which I haven't read yet, he said he gave an interview to the Liverpool Echo about writing it, and he says, let me get the quote. When I wrote my first book, it was early in my career, and you do it because somebody asks you and you think it'll be all right. Your agent at the time says you need to do it, so you just go with the flow. But now when I look back at it, as much as I enjoyed writing it, it's not what I think now.
Ooh.
So I'm thinking that, you know, if we look at this trilogy like a Neapolitan ice cream, the first book was your kind of sickly strawberry.
Yep.
This is the vanilla. I'm hoping for some rich dark chocolate for part three. You know, I'm holding out hopes for part three.
But you found joy in the vanilla at times anyway, at least getting to know his family, right?
At times, like getting to know his family, I thought was really sweet. And, you know, he's obviously very, very close to them. He cites one of the darkest, saddest moments in his life as being when they moved to Madrid, him and Louise, his wife and the baby. And he has to leave for training at 10 a.m. And when he comes back at 1 p.m., he feels terrible and guilty.
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine? This poor woman's got 3 hours respite from him. And he's like, still guilting himself over it years later.
I know what you mean by that. And but he's his family, especially for a lot of his family are really, really lovely to him as well. And I can kind of see why he loves that.
Lovely.
His parents, he says, like how, you know, with all their siblings, they traveled around, watched them doing every single sporting event, really supported them. This one bit, because his dad was obviously a footballer, which I didn't really know much about before. And he says something like, at some point, he says, dad never talked about being a footballer. And I was like, well, he never mentioned it ever. It was just a complete coincidence. Well,
at one point, he said that the newspapers would have told him. He was like, the newspapers mentioned that it was Terry Owen's son playing, as if like Michael Owen's going to read a newspaper and be like, dad, did you play football?
yeah,
a little bit. You might have heard of them. Everton. You heard Everton? Remarkable.
It's very sweet, though. Like, his family all put bets on when he was 7 that one day he'd wear an England shirt and things like that. It's just, they obviously just have a lovely, supportive family. And this, I mean, this is a very well-adjusted, nice man that we're slagging off because he's not weird enough. But in reality, he's had a lovely sort of nice childhood. And we're giving him grief for it. Like, I didn't enjoy the book, but I can't dislike him as a person because I just think he's a product of his environment.
I'm totally with you on that. And that is pretty much what my point is going to be later. So I'm going to try and save those kind of things. But you mentioned just something in there you mentioned about his family putting a bet on him. You never hear about the people who put bets on their kids to play for England. Never did. My dad put 10 grand on. Ruined.
I was going to say, you sound like you're talking from experience right now.
Well, I will say,
I told him not to. I'm shit.
It's a really good job that he is good at football because I have never read or met anyone who bases their whole personality around primary school more. Like, he's obsessed with his primary school. And there's one bit where he talks about he was quite into boxing when he was there. And so I looked it up. This match that he was in was the 4th of March 1990, which means that he was 10. And he still calls the people that he beat victims. His victims. He still refers to them as that. Like, this is a 30-year-old
10-year-olds don't have victims.
Is that just you know, a simple vocabulary issue as opposed
to... No, I feel like that to him is the darkness in it. That's the grit. That's
you're right
moment,
with that. That is true. You know? Yeah, there's not really
there's
any other example.
The will to win, isn't it? He's so competitive. He just wants to win no matter what level, who it is. He wants to win everything.
I've told you guys, we'd all be better if we were a bit more Michael Owen.
He remembers that moment. Like, he talks about how, like, he was, you know, he was boxing in front of the dinner jacket scene, which is a bizarre thing. The idea of, like, what 50 men wearing dinner jackets watching 2 10-year-old boys box. I don't know what was going on in Liverpool in the 90s. But he says, like, so this match was amazing, and like everyone came up to me afterwards being like, you know, you won that'll be the boxer of the day, you're the boxer of the night, well done. And then some other guy won it because he was a heavyweight, and you're like, why are you going into so much detail? You're Michael freaking Owen, and you're like focusing so much on this.
There's an even weirder bit where he just describes a boxing match at South Korea when he's at World Cup 2002. He just writes about, is it Holyfield?
Lewis Mike Tyson.
He just talks about watching a fight on TV for ages. Like, oh, come tell me about what you're doing with Trevor Sinclair. With the boxing, though, there are, I mean, obviously boxing, he did mention in the first book as well. There's quite a lot of topics that pop up a few times. We've already hinted at, like, we get
Jaguars.
More depth in there.
Jaguars. The Jaguars still.
Two Jags Owen, is that what he calls his dad? Two Jags Terry, is that what he calls his dad when he buys him two Jaguars? Imaginative.
Not a single mention of Pepsi Cola.
No,
that's true. Actually,
but there is an incredible moment
ran out by then,
which I forgot from the first book, where he breaks his emotions in an injury. He like injures himself in this horrible injury.
Oh yeah,
and he just he's injured his emotions and he keeps crying all the time. That's why he describes it as an injury to his emotions.
That's so weird. That bit's so actually quite sad as well.
It's because really
he's like,
sad.
Oh, it's not just sad because of what happened. It's sad because he's like, he feels ashamed about the fact that he was crying and all the other Liverpool players make fun of him for crying.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a bit like, oh, guys, come on. And I think that's actually something that probably has changed quite a lot in like how he writes this book. There's a lot of bits where it feels like the Liverpool, he's like, oh, God, the Liverpool players saw me crying or they saw my mum crying and they all made fun of me. And it's like, that's a bit.
Is it his brain? Leave him alone.
Yeah, yeah. He's shut up, Vagon Hegum. His head hurts.
He's got like half a head now. What are you doing?
He's. But also, other things that popped up I noticed. A photo. We have a photo of him with Lara Croft, which is very important to carry on that conversation.
Who he describes as a cartoon character again. So he doesn't quite got his head around the concept.
That is a new level of not knowing what's going on. He clearly knew what was going on in the first book. He forgot and then was like, some kind of cartoon character. But then surely he'd have gone like, am I a cartoon character? I don't play in the video game. Am I a cartoon character?
Michael doesn't play video games. He hasn't got time for them. He doesn't know what they are. He's too busy being good at football and golf and boxing. So, and also, he reveals something. He talks about his house that he made from scratch again, revealing that he has a mini cinema. Now, why? Why? A man who hates films. Why has he got a mini cinema in his house? That makes no sense.
Because he can.
Yeah.
Because he can.
It's good. Like, it looks good in OK Magazine, I reckon.
Yeah, that's true.
You watch golfing videos or football matches, he'll hook them up to it.
But he doesn't like OK Magazine coming round. He's not fussed about the celebrity life.
No.
Again?
Maybe I can imagine he's a big fan of like Danny Dyer's Deadliest Men and stuff like that. I reckon that's his jam.
I love to watch Danny Dyer's Deadliest Men.
I will beat someone up, you know.
Jack, is that... Wait, Tash, is that your... was that Michael
that
Owen
was
or was that Danny Dyer?
Okay. It was kind of half and half. Okay.
So that's Tash's Michael Owen.
Jack's, you slag!
So that's Jack's. Interesting. James, you got one?
It's true that David and I are at opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to our public profiles. It was better before.
Public profiles.
Yeah.
I'm interested to see how these all develop over the series.
Yeah, I'll keep practicing.
Yeah.
I'll get there.
I've got a new section, by the way, guys. Who wants to hear this? Talking about things that we've touched upon in the old books. Here we go. Something that pops up again. This is Michael Jones' watch. Michael Jones' watch. You might remember last week, Michael Jones was, he brought, I don't remember who he was. He was, there was a question.
His best friend at school, right?
He was the golfer that Michael Owen could have been.
Exactly. That was in the Q&A section. They asked, he said, who's your best friend at school? Michael Jones. That's all he said about the matter. I wanted to know more about this character. Oh, actually, sadly, here's something interesting. I'm missing pages 15 to 27 in my book.
Jumps. Oh, no.
Well, yeah, real sad, real shame.
Jack, we got absolutely swizzed reading this whole
thing. You really did. Yeah, old Mikey. Oh, Mikey boy. My best friend from school days is Michael Jones. When I met infant school, he lived about 3 miles away from us. So until I was allowed to ride off my bike, I had to rely on mum to drive me to his house. He turned pro in 2003 and has been to South Africa to play in the Sunshine Tour. There we go. Nice to flesh out the Michael Jones story.
Oh, good.
A bit more.
Have we looked up what he's up to now?
Nah, not yet. We'll find out next episode. In another edition of Michael Jones Watch. Michael Jones watch.
Michael Jones better have his like own chapter and reboot. I want like at least 5, like 50 pages on Michael Jones.
I've been reading Michael Jones' autobiography.
If he was like an international spy now, and he was like, that golf thing was just a cover.
That would be an unexpected turn.
That would be the dark chocolate that I'm looking for.
So last week's book, we talked a lot about France 98, Michael Owen's first international tournament. But Jack, there was another tournament that kind of piqued your interest in this book.
Yeah, Euro 2000 with Kevin Keegan at the helm was my favorite bit of the book. I suppose it was.
Okay.
Yeah, my favorite bit of the book, okay. I would say. Having had like him being exclusively doing really, really, really well, there was something quite interesting about seeing him struggling under a new manager like Kevin Keegan. And I think that what had been like an unbridled success up to this point was kind of brought a bit. It seems like his relationship with Kevin Keegan was quite odd. Like, Glenn Hoddle seemed to big him up at every opportunity and, like, kind of, you know, say, you can do whatever you want. You're the golden boy, the other, you know, it doesn't matter how young you are, you can play, you can be the kid. Kevin Keegan seemed to be like he seemed to want to bring him down a couple of pegs. And we've kind of had that a few times with Kevin Keegan.
Yeah. Like, and his assistant, Derek Fazakerly, I think. Am I right in thinking Stephen Gerrard slagged him off loads?
Stephen Gerrard hated Derek Fazakerly.
Yeah, and Owen mentions in my name, so I don't know what Derek Fazakerly was. What a weird name to say over and over again, by the way. That's a hard name to say.
He said he was quite negative to them and slagged them off a lot. Build
yeah.
I don't like him just at all. He's going in the Hall of Shame. We haven't had one of those in a while. Hall of Shame for Fazakerly. Sorry, Jack. You were saying about Kevin Keegan.
Kevin Keegan seems to want to change his game quite considerably, to the point that he seems to put things in, like, Michael Owen's head quite a lot.
Yeah.
Like, there's a bit where he describes all the things that Kevin Keegan's trying to do. He's like, you know, make sure that you hold back and, like, hold the ball up so you can play it to Alan Shearer, because he's the one to do it there. Like, you make sure you go around and play these wing... Like doing things that aren't natural to Michael Owen's game. Mm-hmm. And there's, to the extent that Michael Owen, in the first match, I think, against Portugal, completely misses the ball at one point. Like, he completely freezes up and the ball rolls past his foot. And he said he, like, turns and looks at Kevin Keegan, and Kevin Keegan's kind of throwing his arms up going, "Oh, you stupid boy." And you have to... This kid's 20.
I forgot he was Captain Mannering.
Yeah, at that point he was Captain Mannering. Don't tell him your name, Owen. There was all that nonsense. I talked about last time how Michael Owen needs to win the book in the first, you know, the first book. He really feels like he needs to win every single opportunity he talks to anyone. And it feels like for the first 80 or so pages, or however long it is, it really feels like Owen's doing everything perfectly. Mm-hmm. Everything is going his way.
Which it absolutely was.
His interaction with Keegan is the first time that it kind of... He seems to lose confidence in himself. And it's quite sad. And I thought you have a kind of... There's a kind of depth there that I don't think you get from his time when he talks to Sven-Göran Eriksson or to Hoddle. There's a kind of vulnerability there that I actually weirdly enjoyed.
Yeah, well, I know what you mean. Because when you kind of put this, you know, entirely... You know, this guy is so together and so sure of himself in a position where all of a sudden he's not got that kind of belief in him. It was interesting. But however, there's fundamentally, I've got something to pick up on here. Kevin Keegan has a go at him for, you know, not holding the ball up well enough and bringing people to play, like you mentioned. However,
yeah,
and he's not bothered. He says, like, I know my strengths. What's the point? I might as well just keep improving my strengths. Literally the next chapter, during the treble, he says, at that time I was working very hard. So he's back at Liverpool at this point. He goes, at that time, I was working very hard on aspects of my game I needed to improve. I was practicing an awful lot. Left foot shots, headers, holding up the ball. And suddenly it seemed it was all paying off. That's literally what he was having a go at, Kevin Keegan, through all that war. And then he goes and does the same thing. And it works perfectly. So Kevin Keegan was right all along in some ways.
I think, when he's talking about Kevin Keegan, that if he'd have said, look, you're really good at your pace is a strength and your finishing. Also add to that holding up the ball and linking up and whatever. He said he wouldn't have minded, but he said he was literally trying to stop him from doing what he was good at and get him to do things that he'd never done before.
Which is what Hulier...
Which is boxing. Hulier
and Sven-Göran Eriksson. Yeah, get back in front of those 10-year-olds. I want to see you fight a 10-year-old, Michael. Like... With Hulier and Hoddle, they definitely did seem to be like, you're really good at this, let's try and add this. With Keegan, there's at one point where he's like, Michael, if you weren't Michael Owen right now, I'd take you off. And it's really like, this kid, he is a little boy. He's a little boy who's struggling in a big tournament. Stop being weird, Kevin Keegan.
I feel like now we've done, you know, like when we did the Karen Brady book and we got the other side of it, though, it's now made me look at these books and think, I want to know both sides of it.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
He only ever, in the whole book, he only ever gives, like, his thought on it. He doesn't really seem capable of visualizing what the other person was kind of
That's genuinely, he, like, in this book, he seems to have no understanding of the team.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
He's solely focused on himself, which is, I think, has probably made him a really good player, but it also makes some of these bits of this book really hard to read. Like, during the World Cup at 98, there's a bit where he talks about how, like, he spends about 5 or 6 pages talking about the penalty that he took at the penalty shootout.
Mm-hmm.
A penalty that was ultimately irrelevant because England went out. Like, it was entirely irrelevant. No one, you know, not because, you know, good for Michael Owen for scoring it, but who cares? We're not talking about how good it was because, you know, it didn't matter. But, like, he talks about it for so long, being like, I was so relieved I didn't miss. I was so happy. I turned to my family and, like, pumped my fists, and I was so
happy.
Which
is very nice.
Even though we then went... Which is nice.
Saw his family in the crowd.
It is really sweet, but it's also a bit like... he talks about as well, like, as we were leaving and, you know, like, England had just been beaten by Argentina in a heartbreaking match, that I myself, like, that's my first moment of being truly devastated by football. Mm. I was screaming. I was so upset. I was just like tears streaming down my face.
And the idea of
Michael Owen, like, leaving the pitch and being like, yeah, I've done quite well there. It's sort of like, I completely understand why.
I think we would all be the same. I really think 18-year-old Kirsten take a penalty in a World Cup final with the world watching on, you go, oh, thank God I didn't miss.
But it's not just
that one incident. Like, he does it quite a lot.
I agree.
There's also another example that's kind of the opposite is when Liverpool win the League Cup for the first time, and he's like, oh, well, I didn't feel like I was part of it, you know, because I was on the sidelines. And at one point he says, like, I had a face on me and I wanted Gerard Houllier to know I was angry. And you're kind of like, well, it's a team thing, and he's trying to make it a team thing.
To him, football is an individual sport.
I think he happens to be good at.
I really do think, I think he sees it like golf and boxing.
I mean, also, like, how many times do we hear about other Liverpool players in this book? But apart from maybe Didier Hamann, Steven Gerrard, and a couple of others, I think you hear more about his racehorses, honestly. I know far more about Etienne.
Maybe they're just very successful Lady horses Etienne. compared to the England team at that time. They had more success.
If Lady Etienne had been on the left wing for Liverpool in 2001, they'd have won the league. I fully believe that.
Right, guys, time for Out of Context, Michael Owen. Jack, kick us off with your favourite quote from the book.
After that incident, I swore I would never use the word concussion unless I was clinically unconscious.
There we go. That's a good one to kick us off. James?
Nothing will ever undermine my love of horses and breeding.
Did you do that in your Michael Owen voice?
Yeah.
Thank you. That was good. I was very impressed.
I'm glad you had to... it can't be a good impression because you just had to ask me if that was my normal voice.
Former England striker Michael Owen. Tash?
I used to love looking for balls. Sometimes I would be 50 yards down the fairway rummaging through the bushes while he was taking his shot.
Yeah, love it.
Very good line, but trust you to go blue. Trust you to go blue.
There's one that's linked to that, which is to get first pick of the washed balls was, to me, a major prize. Filthy.
You guys need to get your head out of the gutter. My one is very much not disgusting. I'm sorry, but you will never stop grown men playing cards with a bit of money on the side, and that's fine. So that's my one.
That's a quite good summary of this, but, like, to him, that is being a real renegade.
Yes, yeah.
Like, some pub gambling is the cutting edge.
You say quite a bit of gambling. 30 grand owed to Kieran Dyer.
30 grand. 30 grand to Kieran Dyer.
Guys, we're halfway through our Michael Owen trilogy officially, and there'll be more of Michael's second book after the break, including Owen on Beckham.
Hello. Hello there. What voice do you want me to do? We will do a little bit. I'll just do my voice.
Do your voice.
Yeah, thanks.
Hello. I'm Joe Marler. People think I hate people, but I don't. I actually love interaction with people. I love finding out what jobs they do and whether I could do what they do. The Joe Marler Show.
Joe Marler Show.
With new episodes every Wednesday.
Welcome back to Football Book Club, where we are reading the second book in the Michael Owen trilogy. James, I know there was an England teammate that you were very interested by in this book.
Yeah, he talks about our David a lot. Our David Beckham.
Beckham. Got it. When you said our David, I immediately went to Gail Platt in Corrie and thought of it. Is David Platt? Is that son?
Lived in the same city.
Is he called David Platt?
No, I feel like David Beckham is our David.
Okay.
Yeah. Sure. Ah, David.
To me, it's David Platt off Corrie. That's my our David, I'm afraid.
To me, it's David Duchovny. So, you know.
We've all got a different David in our life.
We've all got our own Davids.
But his relationship with Beckham is interesting because he clearly likes him. But he's constantly comparing himself to him and justifying why it's fine that they're like polar opposites. It's strange. Like, he's very aware that him and Beckham are very different people, but then he sort of bases everything he does on whether Beckham's done it first or done it differently. And I don't know if it's just like his desire to beat records and being annoyed that Beckham's done it slightly before him or what. It's just, he talks about him a lot. And it's sort of, he goes between sort of saying, we're very different people, we don't really talk that much, to going, yeah, we're best mates. It's like hard to know exactly what their relationship was, I think.
And you didn't even have the Madrid chapter, I don't think.
I didn't.
When they hang out quite a lot. He goes around his house and they don't know, do in Madrid, have a siesta together. They hang out and piss around and in their lovely houses. And I agree with you. I wonder if it's because at the time, obviously, they were the two big superstars. And he mentions France 98 quite a bit. Obviously, Beckham became the country's biggest villain, and Michael Owen became our new darling. And I wonder if, because they were the two big names of the late 90s, early noughties football.
If Beckham was Regina George, then Owen was Lindsay Lohan. Ooh, is Katie Heron. Is that what you're saying?
In not so good...
Nevilles are the other two mean girls.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So who keep on trying to make fetch happen.
And wait. Yeah. And Phil Neville can tell the weather with his tits.
That is what they say about Phil Neville. Did you notice the incredibly catty line that he had about David Beckham?
No.
Yeah, I think I know what it is. Yeah.
It was, I haven't earned the money he has because I haven't smiled for as many cameras or encouraged as much interest in my life.
Yeah. See, that's the grit that Tash likes. That's the grit that Tash
salty.
Likes.
Salty.
Yeah, yikes.
Give me more.
He said something similar as well, where he was like, you know, just because he's like throws himself in front of publicity or whatever, and it's like, oh, okay, Michael.
There's
but then
little,
he's like, it's fine,
edge.
It's fine. We're different. It's fine. Yeah. That's fine. Nobody's right. Nobody's wrong. It's just, there's a, literally on the same page, it's strange because he's talking about Beckham and his relationship with him, and he's like, are we close? We're very friendly, but I don't talk to him regularly. I don't even have his mobile number. And it's like, all right. And then literally on the same page, like in the next paragraph, he's like, David and I talk a lot. We're good mates. We have meals together and discuss the game and other England players. Like, which is it?
You've brought up,
but we don't have our phone number. We just shout. We just shout at each other across the street. I say, do you want to have dinner? Sure.
That is honestly one of the things I was wondering. That is the strange thing, but that really did stick with me throughout the book. I was just wondering, does Michael have his phone number or not? I really couldn't understand it because in Madrid, like, he pops around his house quite a lot. And he says at some point that he gets, every time he wants to call Dave Beckham, he calls his agent who gives him Beckham's number. So just fucking save it. Save it in your phone.
Understand the concept of writing down a phone number or saving it in your phone. Scott, got to ring my agent again.
Where he's like, I don't have David Beckham's phone number. And that's fine. Because, you know, if you think about it, when you're working with like lots of people in a factory, you wouldn't have all their numbers, would you? I don't know what common people do. They work in factories, I suppose. You have,
I love
like,
how
three
he thinks there's
numbers,
only two jobs. There's footballer or working in a factory. Because he mentions it a few times.
There's footballer, factory, and also being an engineer, because that's what his brothers do. And then the bit where he's like, you know, being a footballer and being an engineer, they're both as valuable as each other. And I was like, well, arguably, an engineer is much more valuable. He says, like, you know, if my brother were to put a hole in the wrong bit of an airplane, that'd be really bad. And I'd be like, that happened? Michael, you should tell someone if that's happened.
Do you want to hear about the moment I feel like I finally got Michael Owen?
Yeah.
Look, so most of the book, I was kind of the same as you guys, especially Jack. I was kind of like, oh God, it goes on a lot. I've read a lot of these stories. I mean, again, not necessarily in the same way Jack did, more because I thought, you know, we've covered them in the past, which is a privilege not many readers of Michael Owen Off the Record have had necessarily. So they haven't all necessarily been involved in, you know, a Michael Owen marathon like ourselves. However, I did feel like a lot of the time at the beginning, Michael very much, the way he talks is like an alien learning how to be human a lot of the way through. There was a bit when he first goes into the Liverpool dressing room and he talks about the culture was more laddish, close to the stereotype of how young footballers behave. It wouldn't be unusual to see the odd girly mag lying around the changing room, but it was harmless lad's behaviour. I know from talking to my brothers who work in factories that pranks and factories again, that pranks and jokes are a feature of the workplace everywhere. It sounds like an alien trying to go, these girly mags.
Do you have the girly mags? Perhaps after we have looked at the girly mags, we do the pranks. A feature of all the workplaces.
It's like when Kang and Kodos become Al Gore Clinton and Bill Clinton. Yeah, Bob Dole. Yeah. It's very strange about that. And he talks about the main difference between English and foreign players is the sense of humour. Like he's writing some book about it. If you get up to a prank with someone's toothbrush in the team hotel, a lot of foreign players just won't find that funny. But I'm laughing even as I say this. He's just...
But what's the prank? You can't just keep it incredibly vague
I
and
think
then
there's
say,
a reason
I'm
that
laughing
prank,
about it.
I'm pretty
it's
sure
too blue
reason.
For Michael
yeah,
to say.
That's too blue for the publishers.
I love how he just says all foreign people have no sense of humour apart from Didi Haman.
Yeah, that's very true.
And he's like, Didi Haman's basically English. He's kind of English, really.
Didi gets it. Didi gets it. No one else does. But I went through the whole book kind of thinking, yeah, this guy's a goof. He doesn't know, he's pretending to be, he's not a real person. But then I had a breakthrough. I had a breakthrough, and it's a fairly innocuous moment. Page 257, quite far into the book, I'd say two-thirds of the way into it. I was just reading it, and it's all about, he scores a hat-trick against Kevin Keegan's Man City at Main Road. Uh-oh, ooh, drama. In my occasional Baron spells, I do get grumpy. I admit that. I start to feel as if the world is against me. My suspicion is that some people are enjoying seeing me go through a bad patch. It's just my self-defense mode, but I can feel a rush of goals coming in the hat-trick against City. So fairly nothing, you might think, but... this, I think within that, there's something really, really, really revealing about Michael Owen, around, like, you know, just pap about the goals that he scored. Because I don't know if it was, as Tash mentioned, Stockholm Syndrome or what, but I feel like that at that moment, I started caring for Owen. You could see that he just wants to be loved. He really just wants to be loved. He's worked so hard all his life just getting good at football. That's all he's really done. He's focused on football from really, really, really young age, where it's been given the dairy milk by his grandma, or, you know, being... pushed by his dad to be the best that he can possibly be. And he's focused entirely on that all the time. And he's kind of neglected the social side of things, like, you know, the normal side of being a youngster and going out socializing. So no wonder he's not the most, not perhaps, socially adjusted, you would say. And then he gets criticized about it. It hurts him because, like, he's kind of like, what more do you want? I'm doing everything that I can do. And I feel like nowadays, you look at Michael Owen and with the BT stuff where he gets criticized, and I think he's quite conscious, even at this point within this, you know, heavily propaganda-sized book that we're reading. He's quite conscious that he's not one of these over-the-top characters, like, you know, like these flawed heroes that you usually get in English football, like Gazza or Rooney, or even Robbie Fowler at Liverpool, who he mentions quite a few times, how he says that, you know, the Liverpool fans really take to Fowler. Maybe they haven't taken to me as much. They see him as one of their own, maybe not. So I think despite everything he does, people don't fall for him as much because of that, because he's a bit too polished, a bit too bland, perhaps, in some ways. He's just this goal-scoring machine. And everything he does is incredible. And that's what frustrates him, that he doesn't really know what he can do to impress people anymore. Sorry, this is getting very impassioned. Because he's not fussed either in many ways, because he doesn't want to sacrifice the fact that he's so good at this just for the fame thing, or, you know, to do outrageous things just because it'll make people like him more. Because really, fundamentally, all he cares about is scoring goals and his family. And he absolutely loves his family so much in this whole thing. And he really, 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 really cares about them. There's a whole chapter in here. Given some of the books that we've read, like Darren Huckabee, I think we mentioned in the very first episode, he mentions his wife less than Evander Holyfield in the book. He's got a whole chapter called Gemma, all about his daughter being born. Yeah. And then the next chapter about that is called Life and Death. And he goes into so much depth about this really sad story about where his wife Louise falls off a horse, and he's terrified that he might lose her, or she might be paralyzed. Actually, I think he says he rationalizes really quickly that she's not going to die. He's like, I figured that out straight away. And then from then on...
He does sort of go like, I had like stone cold logic. I was aware of what was going on at that moment.
No,
the only thing I really thought is, I hope she's not paralyzed. And you're like, yeah, oh God.
Yeah, but you can tell at that moment, like, he feels like everything could be collapsing around him at that point. And that's not even an isolated incident. There's so many examples of these, you know, family things all the way through the book. That it's what he cares about. And I feel like we should give him a lot of credit for being a footballer. Perhaps there's not many other things to talk about, like, you know, with, you know, Perry Groves' book, where he's got all these funny anecdotes and stuff like that. Perhaps Owen doesn't have the luxury of that. But he talks about his family so, so, so much in this book around that. And I really feel at the end of the day, that's all he cares about. And you know what? Well, he doesn't need our respect. He doesn't need us. Like, this whole podcast is flawed. Yeah. He doesn't care what we think about his book. He only cares about
his family.
Oh, great.
Now you decided the whole podcast is flawed. Fantastic. Thank you so much for deciding on the second last episode that the whole thing is flawed. Oh, great.
Basically, what I'm saying is, I feel like Michael Owen, I've connected with him more than most other footballers reading this book at that moment. At that moment, I really do. I just felt like, again, we've all been in that situation where you feel like, well, what more can I do? And everything you do, it seems to be making it worse a lot of the time. And I feel like, oh, I see that.
I totally understand what you're saying, but I don't want to read that book.
Yes.
In as much that I don't want to watch the film about the boring person's life.
I totally agree. And I'm not saying it didn't make the book good. It just
made you understand it.
It just made me something understanding, which I think is I think that's the point of the show.
Well, see, okay, so I
it's called the Football Understanding Personalities podcast. Yeah, it's not catchy.
Let's understand this person.
Yeah.
No, see, okay, so I, to an extent, I agree, but then I sort of felt like that with Steve Bruce's book, where it was very dull, but I found him quite charming. For some reason, I find Michael Owen very defensive throughout this whole book, and that's what really grates. He's very defensive on almost every single thing that he does. The amount of times he says, people may say this about me, and then say, and it's probably because he has, you know, had these people say these things, and he's felt very much in the spotlight. Yeah. But it does become quite exhausting after a while, where you just feel like you're, you know, he talks about how many times he's been accused of diving and like, oh, you wouldn't have been insulted if I'd got that penalty. And it grates after a while. And I agree that there are little moments where you feel like you can see that, you know, that poor person put upon personality. But for the most part, I feel like the defensiveness just closes me off from that.
I know what you mean. And I do think he can be a bit bitter at times with a lot of things. But what I'm saying is I get why he is. I get why he's like that. And, you know, to me, he's a footballer, and in much the same way, I can't remember whose book we read, but someone wrote a book where they said like people expect. Oh, it was Steve Bruce actually. I think he wrote something at the end of his book, which was something along the lines of like, you know, footballers, why should they in interviews be or like, you know, be expected to know everything about everything all the time like that? They're footballers. At the end of the day, they're paid to run around for 90 minutes, score more goals than the other team. That's all that kind of matters. And Owen, in many ways, he does that as well. Probably better than anyone who ever read in the podcast before. And if I'm just saying, I'll defend
then,
him.
But don't write three bloody books about it. And also running around.
It just, he seems so unhappy. I just, oh, yeah.
The thing is, I don't mind the defensiveness. It's just, it needs to be more condensed, I think. Like, he doesn't need to keep, like, there's a bit where he's talking about the gambling thing, which, fair enough, he wanted to address it and say, look, I haven't got a gambling problem. It's, you know, I can afford to lose that money, whatever, I don't have a, it's not an issue. But he spends like pages talking about it. And it's like, all right, just say your piece and then just be out of there.
You just move on.
If you want to bet, it's fine.
I agree. Look, bad book. However, Owen's my new best mate. That's basically what I'm saying. And I cannot wait to read the next one to get to know more adventures of my little friend.
I feel like
Michael.
You're going
to
spring it on us that he's coming on next week and only you have made yourself look good and we're all going to get like,
yeah,
I've
already sent him all those clips of Jack slagging him off. So, and I've sent him your impression.
You're making
Tash.
Fun of my snooker table, are you, Jack?
He wasn't very impressed by your impression, Tash. He was very upset by that. But however, I want to end that little segment on just he had a very inspiring, if incredibly basic, life philosophy, which I wanted to treat you all to. Michael Owen's philosophy in life. One of my philosophies in life is that everything will always turn out fine. So there we go. That is Michael, kind of in a nutshell. At the end, despite all that depth, which I kind of went into there, it was kind of negated a little bit. End of the book. Michael heads to Newcastle. Well, not in James' one. And Madrid. We haven't really touched upon Madrid because that's such a. It's really fleeting in the book. He kind of goes to Madrid, doesn't really like it, leaves. In that,
but yeah, and well, it's weird because there's at one point in, and I reckon there was probably another version of this book, because at one point he said, oh, you know, they were looking for, the people said that I was going to leave in January, and I would never do that. I'd never give up after 5 months. I'm, you know, I came all the way out here. I'm not going to give up after 5 months. And then he gives up after 12 months. It's, yeah, like, well, what?
Look, those 7 like, months are very
and,
important.
And he also sort of, and he also implies like that was the plan all along. And I feel like there's a sort of, he feels, he really has it in his head that he's a bit part person in Madrid, I think.
Yes.
Or that people have accused him of being that. He keeps on saying, I scored 16 goals and 29 starts. Not bad for a bit part player, am I?
Which I think is something which was a level at him a lot, to be honest, the best.
No,
I don't remember that time that well, but I kind of remember him being, you know, pinned as a bit of a failure abroad, basically.
Yeah, but I think that's pretty similar to how Bale is perceived as a failure abroad, despite the fact that he's scored loads of goals and been really,
yeah, I'm on four Champions Leagues, a little bit different, but yeah.
No, but like what I mean is like it there's an expectation at Real Madrid that you kind of, once you're there, you have to score loads of goals to stay on, and that, yeah, like he scored 16 goals, that's fine. He just seems very keen to say, like, you know, I did it, I achieved, but if he had achieved more, he probably would have stayed for longer, is how you feel about it.
And you know, look, it was never going to work. He's incredibly homesick. He missed his home cinema back home. He missed everything else.
He said, like, the only thing you can do is sit about watching Spanish TV. And it's like, well, it's not strictly true, but okay.
Sure. Yeah. In Spain, all you can do is watch Spanish TV. They won't let you do anything else. There's nothing else that we can do.
They're always speaking Spanish over there.
Yeah, just don't get it.
Sick of it.
And also, one other thing I noticed, before he went to Newcastle, which we only really get the very beginning of his time at Newcastle from this book, it's a real teaser. Again, it's like a homecoming book, I guess, this thing. Apparently, Wigan tried to sign him. That was very ambitious. Yeah. Newly promoted Wigan trying to sign. Yeah, well, I think in the end they probably went for Omri Camara instead. So that worked out nicely. Big question, did the book change you? I'm going to jump in there straight away. Me, it clearly did change me in some way, because I am very much Team Owen. James, did you enjoy it? Did it change you?
It didn't change me. It was fine. Didn't really enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And that's really my feedback. Sorry.
And you got no closure on the Liverpool segment either. You got no closure on his Liverpool career.
No. I'm hoping Reboot's going to... The third book in the trilogy is going to turn this all around. I've got hope.
Yep.
The cliffhanger at the end of this one is brilliant, though, to be fair.
What's the cliffhanger?
That he's at Newcastle.
Yeah. Whoa, where's it going to go now? This guy?
What's going to happen?
Newcastle? Oh, it's not going to happen. And too much, it doesn't. So, yeah, it does all go wrong. Tash, did it change you?
No.
Okay. But you got to know his family a bit better. You're happy with that?
I did get to know his family, and I now follow his daughter on Instagram, so that's something.
There we go. Yes, we've all got something out of it. Jack, what did you get out of it?
I didn't really get much out of it, I'll be honest.
Okay.
I
you got a book out of it.
Yeah, but even that is on Kindle, so it's fleeting, isn't it? I mean, I suppose what I got out of it is the acknowledgement that existence is fleeting.
Perfect. Well, at least, like I say, we all got something out of it. Yeah. That's all. Jack, I feel very bad that we're putting you through something that we don't want to do. I feel...
Do you know what, Jay? I've been joking a lot here, but you really should feel bad.
I don't feel that bad. Rating out of 10, guys. What are you going to give it to put it on the leaderboard? Let's kick off with who's going to be the least brutal? James. Let's kick off with James.
Whoa. You never would have said that
before. I know. Something's changed. Something's flipped the series.
5, right in the middle.
Okay. I'm actually going to give it, despite all I said, I'm going to give it a 3, because I really didn't actually enjoy the book.
Oh, what the hell? I know. What are we doing here?
I know, but it was really just that moment. I honestly agreed totally with you. The book all the way through, I didn't enjoy it, and I'm not trying to spring a surprise. I just found that little segment so insightful, and I feel like I'm very interested to follow this part.
How has this happened?
Tash, what did you give it?
Oh my God. I feel like you're doing some sort of like mental treatment on us that you're going to... What is going on? I will give it a 4.
4, okay. And Jack?
I'll give it a 5. Sure, it's fine. It was absolutely fine.
Shock. It's like when they send the wrong group home from judges' houses just now. That's how I feel. Yeah.
What are you doing?
I totally agree with you about the book. I found the book.
No, you don't.
I do.
You spent close to an hour saying how much you loved it.
I disagree with you guys about Michael Owen, but I don't disagree with you about the book. I think the book was a bad read. It was very hard to read.
Your speech was like akin to Al Pacino in Scent of a Woman when you
really
get
was.
Up and just
I can't trust any compliments from you ever. You could say the nicest things about someone and then go like, oh, you know what? He's 3 out of 10. That guy, 3 out of 10.
The book has gone down my estimations, but Michael Owen massively up in my estimations for reading this. I separate the art from the artist. I'd massively head on it. I just feel like it's not about the notes he's playing. It's about the notes he's not playing.
Oh my God.
That's what it is.
Your words are making me angrier.
Like, you reading this book and giving this feedback is making me view you differently.
Wow, interesting.
Because I feel like if you identify with him that closely, then...
Oh, that's true.
You know?
This at least means that Michael Owen definitely isn't going to be on the podcast. That's a relief.
We've knocked that on the head. So that's another 4.25. It's got exactly the same as it got last time. So he hasn't gone up, hasn't gone down. Both books have got 4.25.
That's about right.
That's because some weirdo gave him 3!
For the quiz this week, you're all named after some of Michael's strike partners from this period. So Jack, you're Ronaldo. Tash, you're Alan Shearer. James, you're T.T. Kamara. Okay, excited?
That's unnecessarily cruel.
Question number one. According to Michael, what 2 things do you need to take a penalty?
Ronaldo.
Yes.
I mean, arguably Ronaldo. Yeah, you probably need Ronaldo to take a penalty.
Yeah.
Spuds?
Very good, yeah.
And, I don't know, football boots.
Close enough. A good finish and a decent pair of spuds, which he says.
Decent pair of spuds.
Which he means.
He says that Alan Shearer probably has the biggest pair in the world.
Yes, he says Alan Shearer's probably got the biggest pair of spuds. I'm not sure if that's insight into the dressing
room. I do have the biggest pair of spuds in the world, to be fair.
Yeah, that's true. That is true. Tash is really, again, in much the same way I kind of channeled Michael Owen, Tash is channeling Alan Shearer and his big spuds.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
Big spud energy.
Yeah. Question number 2. More Sander Vesterveld trivia. So last week we learned that, what was it? He's good at the weakest link game or something, wasn't it? Or Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? The Who Wants to Be a Millionaire game. This week, apart from some dodgy performances on the pitch, what else do you do to lose his place in the team?
Although,
Yeah.
He blogged.
Yes, yes. He wouldn't stop talking freely on websites.
On internet websites.
Yeah. Like he's
Hi guys, Sander Vesterveld here.
Like he's Perez Hilton. Just like slagging off the rest of the team. Bizarre.
You won't believe what Vaard Hegem was wearing this week.
XOXO.
Question number three. Who was Michael Owen's golfing partner at Real Madrid?
Titi Camara.
It wasn't him.
Ronaldo.
He's correct. Yeah, very confusing. Yeah.
Oh, I should have. That was the one I should have got. I should have jumped
tricked
in on.
You into that. Of course, we're talking about the.
That bit was so strange. I didn't have the Real Madrid bit.
Wait, yeah, you said you didn't have.
How
the
do
Real
I know
bit.
That?
What the heck?
How do I know that?
What happened here?
I have a vivid story in my mind of.
What is happening?
I must have seen that in an interview somewhere.
This is one of the strangest sort of book clubs.
What the hell? I just realised I was the strangest bit, and I was like, hang on a minute, that wasn't a bit.
I feel
that's
like
just something I
the
know.
45 minutes we had trying to figure out our tech before this recording has put us all in a very strange place this episode. Apologies to the listeners. That is bizarre. And also,
I feel like at the end of The Sixth Sense, I don't know what's going on.
Also, I think Cesar Sanchez, the very briefly Spurs goalkeeper, was another one, I think. And there, that was the other answer. So it's 2-1, all to play for still. So quick fire, I'm going to give you a few things. You got to tell me if it's in the index or not. Number one, Nelson Mandela.
Oh, Ronaldo. Yes.
Is correct. Sorry, Alan Shearer, you got to be in there with your big spuds quicker. Number two, is it in the index? Evander Holyfield.
Oh, Ronaldo.
Yes.
Yeah, of course it is, because he talks about Evander Holyfield playing against Lennox Lewis.
I think it's Mike Tyson versus Lennox Lewis, actually.
But doesn't he? No, he also plays against Evander Holyfield, doesn't he? No!
Alan Shearer? Yeah. No, because it was in the first book.
No!
Actually, it is. He is in the index. I'm sorry to say, turn around. But I was just correcting on that. So yeah, you are right with that point. And finally, Jumanji. Is it in the index?
Titi Camara, no, it's not. Why would a film be in?
It's very good, very good point. So I think at the end of that, football's the winner. I can't remember.
Ronaldo's the winner.
As a reward, you'll get Ken Zong this week. You remember Ken? He's the master of writing chants for long since retired players, and you all remember he's been set this task to, you know, as we read the Michael Owen books, he's going to come up with three Michael Owen chants every week. I'll be honest, I think he's struggling. Accounts for this.
Do you know what? If we're struggling, he should struggle.
Yeah, I don't know if Ken's been part of this call along, but he's struggling just as much as we are. This week, to the tune of Chaka Khan's I'm Every Woman. He's Michael Owen. Just set him free. Any goals you want scored, baby. He does it naturally.
Oh.
Oh. So that was Ken's chant.
Yeah, it's good. It's good.
Yes, it's hard. It's a hard name to write three chants about. I really shouldn't have set him this task read, to be honest. He's really... really struggling with it.
I quite fancy next week him doing Ariana Grande's God is a Owen.
That's good.
God is a Owen. Okay.
Yeah. You'll believe that God is an Owen.
What about Omen by The Prodigy? I don't know how you could do that, but it's an Owen.
It's an Owen.
Two books down, everybody. We are almost there. Next week, how are we feeling, first of all? Feeling good?
I'm on the edge. I'm on the freaking edge right now.
Let's see if we can push him over next week. When we read our final chapter of the Michael Owen trilogy, his 2019 book, Reboot, much more recent, also nominated for Autobiography of the Year at the Sports Book Awards 2020. So,
good.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think this was nominated for anything.
But then 2020 was a weird year, so, you know.
All right. Yeah, look, go into it with your expectations.
I don't want to get my expectations too high, is what I mean.
Yeah, I don't think there's any danger of that from what you've been saying with Michael Owen this whole thing. If you've read any of the Michael Owen books, we'd love to hear from you. Remember, you can find us on Twitter at Footy Book Club, Instagram at Football Book Club, and we're on Facebook, or email us at fbc@crowdnetwork.co.uk. We're going to record 20 minutes extra Owen action now, exclusively for our Football Book Club members. If you haven't already joined, basically, you can access all of our bonus chapter episodes that we make. They're 20 minutes long every single week, as well as exclusive events, and get your own Football Book Club bookmark, all for a very reasonable price. Head to patreon.com/footballbookclub to find out more. They should join, shouldn't they, guys?
Absolutely. We had some great chat last week.
Really great chat.
What did we chat about last week? I can't remember.
I can't remember.
It was great.
I think you mentioned something about Trevor Sinclair living in Dubai.
Oh yeah, that was cool. I did enjoy that.
The fact that I gave out was not factually accurate. I can't revisit that at some point. Anyway, to hear my factually inaccurate facts, jump onto that. Thanks again, everyone. And also, you know what? We've been through a lot this series. Last week is the last book of the series that we're reading and the last book of the trilogy. I'm going to treat you guys. We're all going to go out and we're going to meet in person next week and actually be back together and read it. The world's reopening. We're reading Michael Owen's reboot. Let's see each other. You looking forward to it?
Yeah.
All right.
Jack, no. I can't wait.
I can't wait, genuinely. I'm very excited about the fact that we're meeting.
Can we all wear full kit?
Yes. Nah.
Oh, I can't watch
that. we'll still clear that. We'll see. Maybe. All come.
Maybe.
Yeah, and
I'll put it on underneath my clothes.
Yeah, exactly. Any last words this week, guys?
Three!
See you next week. Thanks for listening to Football Book Club. It featured James Bug, Jack Bernhardt, Natasha Daniels, and James Balgen. It was created by James Bug, and it was a Crowd production. Thanks to Michael Owen for writing the book, but what are they all up to now? Well, guess what? You're just going to have to listen to next week's episode to find out in the final part of the Michael Owen trilogy where we read 2019's reboot. See you then. Bye-bye.
Crowd Network. A place where you belong.